This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Not to get all Newtonian on you here, but in taxes, as in physics, for every action, there is an equal and opposite reaction. Call it Newton's third law of fiscal policy. How about that? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdal. Monday, the 18th of December. Good as always to have you here, everybody. After a solid 6 weeks or so of discussion, the debate over the tax bill this week enters the "it's basically a done deal, now what are you going to do about it" phase. That goes for people in this economy trying to find loopholes and workarounds for the new Internal Revenue Code. And it's likely a lot of states are going to be doing the same thing next year, trying to protect residents who are facing some new state and local tax realities. Marketplace's Sabri Benishore gets us going.
Once the tax bill is law, you won't be able to deduct as much of your state and local taxes as before, which is unpleasant if you pay a lot of state and local taxes. David Miller does. He's a lawyer with Proskauer in New York City.
I would consider moving. Staying in New York City has gotten much more expensive since this agreement has been reached on the federal tax bill.
This is a fear states have, says Miller, who specializes in tax law. People who pay a lot of taxes might get up and go. Some economists say in reality, a stampede is very unlikely, but states have plenty more reasons to worry.
There is a concern that their ability to fund public services will go down.
Meg Wehe is with the Institute on Taxation and Economic Policy. State and local taxes seem a lot higher now that you can't deduct them. Taxpayers might be a lot less tolerant of them now, let alone be okay with tax increases in the future.
There are multiple ways that states can get around it.
Darian Chansky is professor of law at UC Davis. States with higher taxes, he says, are going to look for ways to get you your deduction one way or another. One loophole they could use, there are still certain types of taxes you can deduct.
The deduction for giving to charity is still maintained.
Wouldn't it be nice if states could magically turn state and local taxes into a charitable contribution to state and local government? The way it would work is people would donate to the state, and in return, the state would lower the actual income tax. The state gets its money, you get your deduction. There are several loopholes like this, all focusing on converting non-deductible taxes into some other tax that can be deducted.
That's the game.
Ultimately, it's a game with the federal government over tax revenue. And if states play this way, the game could very well be a tie. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishore for Marketplace.
The White House rolled out its first formal national security strategy today. No small number of economic line items in the thing. China, international trade, also climate change, or the absence of it. While both of President Trump's immediate predecessors spoke of the national security implications of a warming planet, Marketplace's Andy Euler takes this look at what its omission could mean for funding.
Well before the Obama administration declared climate change a national security threat in 2015, climatologist Peter Glick wrote a paper on the subject in 1989. He says the new strategy from the White House ignores reality.
The military isn't raising the level of the docks at Norfolk Naval Base for fun. They're raising it because they understand that climate change is already affecting their own operations.
Despite ridding the national security agenda of language about climate change, the $700 billion defense bill Trump signed last week calls climate change a direct threat to U.S. national security. It notes 128 military bases are at risk. Threats range from sea level rise to civil unrest caused by drought. Josh Busby teaches public policy at the University of Texas at Austin. He says today's declaration won't likely affect the budget.
It doesn't really have anything to do with money. We have capabilities to kind of walk and chew gum and prepare for multiple threats because we have to. I think on some level, it's because the last administration did it, we're doing the opposite.
This declaration alone doesn't defund programs or reshuffle the Pentagon's agenda, says Robert Lempert at the RAND Corporation. But he says it could limit coordination and eventual spending on aid to victims of natural disasters or climate refugees.
Do people in one agency talk appropriately to people in other agencies so they can connect the dots?
Because if the Department of Defense, Homeland Security, Congress, the White House, and other agencies all have different ideas about the risks of climate change, responding to its impacts is going to be tough. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
Come New Year's Day, New Yorkers are going to be able to take paid leave when they give birth or adopt a new baby, or if a family member becomes ill and needs care. That'll make it five states and the District of Columbia mandating paid family leave in the absence of a federal requirement. Marketplace's Tracy Samuelson looks at the momentum behind state-level initiatives like this one.
The first state to require paid family leave was California way back in 2002. In recent years, Rhode Island, New Jersey, New York, Washington State, and Washington, D.C. have all followed. It's an issue that seems to be getting more traction at the state level rather than federal. Vicki Shabo is with the National Partnership for Women and Families.
In this past legislative session, 31 states had bills introduced. Massachusetts has a very active campaign happening. New Hampshire also has an active campaign, as does Vermont.
These programs are typically funded by a small payroll tax, less than 1% of a worker's salary. In New York, private employees will be able to get half their salary for up to 8 weeks next year. Ruth Milkman is a sociologist of labor at City University of New York.
Here's the thing. These programs are extremely popular politically. All the polls show this. That doesn't mean it's easy to legislate it.
Opponents think it should be left to the private sector. Some business groups argue it's disruptive and costly for employees to take time off, even if employers aren't paying those wages. Nationally, a family leave bill has been introduced in Congress, and the GOP tax plan tries to build some incentives for private companies that offer paid leave to their employees. But Angelo Rashidi with the American Enterprise Institute thinks it's unlikely Congress will go further.
You know, it's still of interest. I think the debate, though, is still around how to actually do it. And I'm not sure that the progress has been made yet on that front.
She's skeptical we'll see national paid leave anytime soon. I'm Tracy Samuelson for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, it's all good. Most of it. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The governor of Puerto Rico, Ricardo Rossello, said today he is going to order a formal investigation into the number of people who've died since Hurricane Maria hit nearly 3 months ago. There is a wide disparity between the official toll and the number of deaths documented by reporters who've been doing some digging. As of today, just as an update, 69% of the island's pre-storm power generation is back online. There is still the matter of more than $70 billion in debt the government is going to have to deal with, and depopulation is becoming a problem. All the while, businesses are trying to get back on their feet. On a recent reporting trip to the island, Lizzie O'Leary, the host of Marketplace Weekend, profiled two companies, one big, one small.
I just smelled it. I think because the breeze crossed us, I just got my first whiff.
A whiff of Bacardi rum.
When you're fermenting, you're also producing carbon dioxide and other things with smell, and that's what you're able to smell right now.
That's Jose Class, Bacardi's manufacturing director. It smells amazing, by the way, like molasses. We're at the company's 127-acre campus in Cataño, 10 miles from San Juan. The green grass is mostly back. Several trees are gone. Sidewalks connect a series of buildings overlooking the ocean.
Right now, it looks completely different and beautiful. This really looked like a battlefield.
Bacardi was back up and running less than 2 weeks after Maria. Good news for a place with 300 employees and one that makes 80% of the company's rum. A little tour bus rolls by, another part of the business here. Today, it's got hurricane recovery workers on a day off.
We received, I would say, 1,000 tourists per day. Currently, we're receiving 30.
This place usually makes 100,000 liters of rum a day. Right now, that's a challenge.
There is no power, so if we want to go upstairs, we need to go through the stairs. Are you okay with that?
I'm okay with that. How many stairs are we going up?
A lot.
Okay. It is dark in here.
Yep. Power.
because we are between the two plants in San Juan. We actually had electricity the week after the Hurricane Maria.
Really?
Yeah. But then after a few days, it started collapsing every day. And there's no way you can sustain an operation like that.
So for supply and distribution?
We have between 1 and 2 months that, in theory, I could keep providing the market without any change with the plant stopped. And that is something that we have done for ages because we have always lived under the threat of hurricanes.
Up on a rooftop, we look down on 500,000 barrels of aging rum worth around $200 million. But while this place has been able to pay its staff during the recovery, 9 miles away in Toa Baja, the story is very different. Downed power lines hang close to the doorway of Juan Orta's convenience store. The open sign, abierto, is crisscrossed with wires and only half lit. Like Bacardi, Orta reopened 2 weeks after Maria.
Basically, we're spending $400 in diesel every 4 days.
He runs his generator 24 hours a day, even though his store isn't open then.
I lost between $20,000 to $25,000. I had freezers filled with meats. Now I only buy basically what people consume in 1 day.
The shelves have canned goods. The refrigerators hold just a little turkey, some eggs, cheese, and some milk. And that money to reopen?
My savings. I had to use it. I had no other choice.
Orta's home was also flooded in the storm. He's applied for FEMA assistance for that, but not for the store. And he doesn't know how long he can stay open.
It's basically been a lot of effort to try and stay on my feet, but we're on our feet. And we'll keep fighting until God permits.
For someone without the deep pockets of a global company behind him, he's pretty much on his own. I'm Lizzie O'Leary for Marketplace.
Don't look now, but Greek government bonds turned out to be some of the best fixed income investments to be had in the Eurozone this year. And after 8 years of bailouts and austerity, and then some more bailouts and some more austerity, there is speculation Greece could be set free from the supervision of its international creditors next year. That would be a huge development. But here in the present day, Greece is still the most troubled economy the Eurozone has. And as the BBC's Ed Butler reports from Athens, the Greek people are still feeling a whole lot of pain.
Demonstrations in Athens against online property auctions. After years of stalling, the government has agreed to international lenders' demands that banks start to sell off some of their repossessed homes. That is essential, the banks say, to clear their huge pile of bad debts. Thousands of homeowners have failed to repay their mortgages over the years of crisis, and it is a highly sensitive issue in this country. I spoke with Christos Megalou. He's the CEO of Greece's largest private lender, Piraeus Bank.
All the properties that we will be tendering in the electronic auctions do not relate to primary homes, but corporate loans that have been given as collateral.
So basically what you're saying is a small businessman will have mortgaged his own home to get a loan for his business to get his startup going. That's failed, and now he's going to potentially lose his home.
We are going to be quite sensitive in situations and that, but in order to be able to restore the credit culture in this country, you need to take some action.
2 out of 3 venues are closed already. Nobody is interested to make a business out of it again because nobody has the money to invest.
Panayiotis Pifeas, showing me around his downtown district of Athens. Panayiotis has been out of work since July.
I have been working in a kitchen as a cook for 2 months in the tourist industry. A horrible experience, actually. 13 hours work, 13 a day, 6 days a week. It feels horrible and it feels very disappointed because why am I even here? I mean, this is the question. What am I doing here? How can I survive to that? Everything else is getting expensive. I cannot stand it anymore, you know.
What are you going to do?
Most probably, I will have to travel somewhere else, find a job, which is not so easy thing when you are 52.
You're going to leave Greece?
I'm pretty sure I will have no choice in a couple of months.
Perhaps the biggest problem then for Greece is persuading people here like Panayiotis that recovery is imminent and it really is possible. In Athens, I'm the BBC's Ed Butler for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Although the pain point hasn't been reached yet, we're almost there.
The pain of getting to work. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is up 140 points this Monday, about a half percent, 24,792. The NASDAQ boosted 58 points, about 0.8%, 69.94. S&P 500 up 14 points, about a half percent, 26.90 there. With the tax bill headed to a final vote this week, more likely than not, Intuit, which offers financial and accounting tax prep software, collected 0.9%. Liberty Tax and H&R Block both credit about 1.8%. Today, Hershey's gave a big kiss to Amplify Snack Brands with news that it offered $921 million for the maker of Skinny Pop popcorn and Oatmega protein bars, whatever those are. Hershey's up 0.1%. Amplify up 71%. Today, Twitter clicked up 11% after announcing it's going to crack down on content that threatens violence. Bonds fell, yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 2.39%. You're listening to Marketplace. Here's an investment opportunity with a guaranteed return. When you donate to support Marketplace today, your gift is going to be matched dollar for dollar by our friends at Candida. Listeners like you who give to Marketplace do more than help keep the show on the air. You help us grow and get better. It's a way to directly support independent reporting and journalism that you can trust. And the payoff comes with what you hear every day. So please don't miss out on this chance to make your donation go twice as far. Give today at marketplace.org, and thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We talked about the tax bill a little bit up at the top of the program, how it's prompting some rethinking by state and local officials, the third Newtonian law of fiscal policy. And while it might seem to the innocent bystander that once this thing passes, that's it, done deal, the truth is this bill is going to be with us for a while as lawmakers and taxpayers try to deal with both its short and long-term effects. Stephen Dennis covers the Senate for Bloomberg News. Thanks for coming on.
It's great to be here.
First thing I want to do, actually, is make sure people remember that there's a, yes, it's $1.5 trillion tax cut, but there is this provision in the law called pay-as-you-go, which means these provisions are going to have to be paid for somehow.
That's true. There is a pay-go law. The Republicans say they're just going to waive that law, but that requires Democratic votes here in the Senate. We still don't know if Democrats will just roll over and allow that waiver to take effect. If they don't, potentially Medicare, farm subsidies, a bunch of other programs could be cut next year.
Talking about things that are going to have to happen next year and in the out years, there are expiration dates on some of these personal income tax cuts. There's a whole bunch of other provisions that kind of guarantee we're going to be talking about this law for the next, 5 to 8 years, perhaps?
This is a pretty big tax cut up front, and then it starts phasing out. A lot of those tax cuts start expiring, starting in 2 years. But sorting all that out is going to be the job of the next several Congresses and future presidents. And so it's not what you would draw up if you were going to design like a tax reform plan in a lab where you want a stable tax policy where people can depend on what the future is going to be. Instead, this is going to be sort of another situation where Congress is going to have to keep on making decisions or else people are going to be hit with various fiscal cliffs.
You remember how we were talking, speaking of fiscal cliffs, you remember how we were talking about the Bush tax cuts in 2012? That is 10 years after they passed?
Yeah, actually, it was sort of 12 years because they had to kick the can down the road a couple of times before then. And, you know, we could end up with a very similar situation in 2025 where a future Congress, future president face hundreds of billions of dollars in tax increases that would happen automatically unless they acted.
Turn this to the political for me for a second. The specifics are a little bit different, but it's worth remembering here that the Affordable Care Act, Obamacare, was passed without a single Republican vote. This now will pass without a single Democratic vote. And here we are playing political ping pong again with large chunks of the American economy.
you know, I think Republicans and Democrats will tell you that when you do these partisan maneuvers, the policies themselves tend to be less durable. When you do have bipartisan bills, like the 1986 tax reform mm-hmm. bill that everybody keeps referring to, those policies tend to be a little bit more durable because both parties have something invested in them.
Yeah, it just occurred to me, actually. The 1986 bill lasted for 31 years. This one won't.
One of the things that's a problem for Republicans right now is this bill is pretty unpopular. People think it's going to raise their taxes, even though most analysts think it's going to actually cut most people's taxes. If next year in February and March most people see larger paychecks, it becomes more popular. Maybe that helps their prospects next year in the midterm elections. Republicans are looking to get shellacked in the midterm elections, and they need to turn those fortunes around.
Stephen Dennis covers the Senate for Bloomberg. Stephen, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Anytime.
Getting to work is one of the economic realities of life. It affects where we work, where we live, and increasingly where companies decide to put themselves. With real estate prices inside city limits rising, a lot of companies are moving out to the suburbs where there is more space and cheaper rent. But that decision creates its own problem for some of those companies. How to get millennials, who increasingly don't own cars, don't care much for driving, and like living in town, how to get them to do the reverse commute? From WGBH in Boston, Aaron Schachter reports.
Laura Montero Stern hates to commute by car, so she says she was ecstatic when her company, the medical device maker Boston Scientific, set up a bus route from her Boston neighborhood directly to the company's headquarters 25 miles away in Marlboro.
You don't have to deal with traffic or snow. You know, it's late, you don't want to drive in the dark or whatever. It's super easy.
The bus also has Wi-Fi, morning news shows on the TV, and a single-serve coffee machine that makes surprisingly good Java. Buses like this can cost around $250,000 a year to lease. Boston Scientific, with 1,600 employees, can afford to pay for private transportation, but it's big money for smaller businesses. That's why transportation planner Stephanie Hershon is trying to get companies and office parks to pitch in a few grand each every month on private dedicated bus routes or vans, or even create incentives for old-fashioned carpooling.
Over the past 15 years in this region, employers, the municipalities, have not come to the table when it comes to resources for transportation. And the employers, although the pain point hasn't been reached yet, we're almost there.
That pain point will be when some of the most recognizable companies in the world, like GE, IBM, and Raytheon, won't be able to attract workers, especially young workers, because there's no practical way to get here from the city without a car. Hershon, who's with the Metro West 495 Transportation Management Association, works with hundreds of companies in nearly three dozen communities in the western suburbs of Boston. But she isn't the only planner scrambling, not by a long shot.
Virtually the entire transportation system in the United States is designed around getting people downtown.
Yonah Freemark is a PhD student in city planning at MIT. He says that design was for obvious reasons. Downtowns are hubs, and there just isn't the same density out in the burbs. But Freemark says the hub system is so 20 years ago.
For several decades now, the majority of jobs in every metropolitan area in the United States, including Boston, have been outside of the city itself. So most jobs are actually in the suburban areas.
There are planning types pushing another way to get young folks to work in the burbs, entice them to live there. I meet Jessica Strunken at a Starbucks in the town of Shrewsbury. She's with the 495 Metro West Partnership, a development consortium. We're sitting in a new complex that also has a Whole Foods supermarket, other shops, and fancy apartments that aren't that much cheaper than what you'd find in Boston. This concept is not new in other parts of the country, but towns in suburban Massachusetts are just catching on, mainly to lure that ever-popular younger demographic.
Now you have
more housing near the downtown, as well as this mixed-use shopping with restaurants and other amenities that people can actually walk to, and there are sidewalk systems.
A sidewalk to downtown may be appealing, but back on the Boston Scientific commuter bus, Jennifer Fusco tells me cities are still a young person's best friend.
At nighttime, my friends like to do trivia or go somewhere fun to brunch, and all the good spots are in the city, and it's nice to not have to drive.
For now, companies are just hoping that people like Fusco, who aren't thrilled about driving, are willing to get on the bus. In Boston, I'm Aaron Schachter for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out, the stock price of note today is $300,269.45 per share. Those are, of course, the A shares of Warren Buffett's holding company, Berkshire Hathaway, crossing $300,000 each for the first time. Nobody else is even close, let alone up into like four digits. Value investing is the phrase you are looking for here. When Buffett took over in 1965, by the way, a single share of Berkshire could have been yours for $11. Hoo boy, look at the time. We've got to go. Wall Street up today. Let's just leave it at that. Our daily production team includes Bridget Bodner and Daisy Palacios. Tommy Andres is the producer on our special projects desk. Caitlin Esch is on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. And this is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.